Hope is the thing with feathers.
Hope is the thing with feathers.
That's like a bird.
Like a bird.
That perches in the soul.
That perches in the soul. Welcome to the Thing with Feathers podcast, a podcast about birds and hope. I'm your host, birding enthusiast, Courtney Ellis. Welcome back to the Thing with Feathers podcast. I'm your host, Courtney Ellis, and I don't like to play favorites, but I have to say, today's guest is our first repeat guest, and I have loved all of our guests. They have been knowledgeable and amazing, but I do have a special place in my heart for today's guest. Hi, Daryl.
Hey, Courtney. So good to be back with you.
This is Daryl Ellis, my husband of almost 17 years.
Amazing.
Been a long and beautiful journey. Thank you for coming back on the podcast.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You helped me start it off and we had no idea all the places that it would go. We've been in multiple different countries. We've gotten some great fan mail and we've been an encouragement to people, which has been part of the reason I started it. So here is the question that I get all the time from our listeners. Is Daryl a birder yet? When we started the show, you were clear that like you weren't anti-bird, but it just wasn't really your thing. Has anything changed in the last 12 months?
I would say I'm either a birder adjacent or I'm a hobby birder. I definitely take joy in receiving when the Lord provides a bird. I don't think I like, and I know probably more than your average non-birder, partly because I have had moments of, you know, using Merlin and being interested in, especially when I travel someplace new, what are the new birds in the area? I find myself in conversations with people where they look at me like, oh yeah, you know that bird fact. And I'm like, yeah, it's because Courtney's told me it two or three times. It's not because I sought it out by myself. So I'd say I'm in that intro sort of hobbyist birder place where I take great joy in what I notice birds and the role they have in creation. I don't have that same burning passion that a lot of birders have where like on a Saturday, it's just what I want to do and I need to go to the wetlands, but I rejoice that, that you do and that many do. So.
You know a lot more than you used to.
For sure.
And that's been fun. When you travel now, I'll get a text and you're like, look what I saw, look what I found. And I'm both excited for you and always a little jealous because I haven't seen that bird yet and you're in New Mexico or wherever you are. So birding adjacent. So sometimes I talk with folks and they're like, well, I'm not really a birder. And I say, well, do you like birds? Like, do you look at birds? Do you notice birds? You're a birder. The bar is really, really low. The bar for expert ornithologist is something I will never reach. But you can be a birder if you look out your window and think, hey, that's cool.
That's a good distinction between ornithologist and birder.
So, totally. Yes, I do not
I
claim
notice,
that label.
I appreciate and celebrate birds for sure.
I notice and appreciate and celebrate that about you.
Yes.
So
I think our kids are birders though. Yeah, no, it's fun to watch. I think I take almost more joy in them noticing birds and the way that that's been starting to be passed on generationally. And I'll have these moments where they'll be like, hey, you know, Lincoln in particular likes pointing out what kind of hawk or eagle it is. And it surprises me. And I love it because I know that when I was his age, I probably noticed pigeons and that's it, you know. So that's a really cool thing to witness.
And they all notice different kinds of birds. Like Lincoln is the raptor kid. Like he really likes the birds of prey. And Wilson is the kid who notices everything. And Fizzy's really into crows. And every crow is like this new delight. Like she's, you know, she's never seen one before. And it's fun because they're everywhere.
Totally.
It is one of my points of pride that the kids are a little bit interested in birds. And not because I've pushed it, just because it's kind of all over our lives right now and they've sparked a little interest, which brings me great joy. Passions are better when they're shared.
Absolutely.
So you are a systematic theologian by training, which first of all, tell people what that is, because I think a lot of people, even in the world of Christendom, are not really clear on different types of theologians. What's a theologian? What's a systematic theologian?
Yeah, so a theologian would be like a banner term for anyone who gets specialized training in the history and thought of the church or the gospel or biblical studies. They typically have someone who doesn't have specialized training who thinks a lot about the faith. But typically in common parlance, right, that they have some sort of specialized training where they've got an MA or an MDiv or a PhD. And, I have a good friend of mine, Dan Van Voorst, who has a podcast, who goes to our church as well. And he's a historian by trade, so he'd be a theologian too, but it's been clarifying to me as to what it means to be a systematic theologian when I'm with him, because he's a historical theologian. So if you ask him like the history of the Reformation, he has it like at hand, like in his mind, all the details and exactly how he'd walk you through the historical arc of not just the Reformation in general, but every sort of sub story of the Reformation. My mind doesn't work like that. I got training in the history of ideas and the history of theology and the church. And my mind very naturally, once I internalize the details, I go to concepts and ideas and how that they're related to one another. So how is creation related to covenant, related to redemption, related to Christology, the theology of Jesus, related to the work of the Spirit? How is that related to the doctrine of the church and ecclesiology? And so a systematic theologian works with ideas and the relationship between ideas. That's how my mind naturally works. So that's the kind of theologian I am.
So theologian by training, but now pastor by trade.
Yeah, pastor by trade. And one of the great joys of what I get to do in our local church is practice as a theologian. And, you know, there's lots of academic life that can be quite combative and who's right. And you get into all the minutiae. And I really burned out on that part of academia. Like theology is just not meant to be a fighting matter. And theology is meant to induce awe and worship and conversation and appreciation and knowledge and experience of God. And one thing I love about working in the church is like, that's all low hanging fruit for most people. Like to talk about the Trinity or talk about Jesus, what it means that he redeems us. Like, it's not like you're getting into all the places of conflict. Like, you're just getting into the basics of the faith, and people are so grateful for that. And I think there's a great hunger for that. And I love inviting people into the wider history and theology of the church and teaching them, inviting them into that sort of long journey of the church over the two millennia that it has existed, and how the truth and the gospel, the truth of God and the gospel, has held up over time and been developed in our understanding of it, and what it can teach us about living well today.
One of my proudest moments of you in ministry was early on. We were interns together. So we've gone through this journey together. I've been ordained, it'll be 13 years in January, and you've been ordained almost 10. But we did a bunch of internships together. And one was out at First Presbyterian Church in Burbank, your hometown. And we had to teach these Christian education classes, and there were different topics, and the topic of the Trinity came up. And I said, not it. And everyone else said, not it. And Daryl said, I'll take that one. And you taught this beautiful class where you made this very elevated concept so simple and so approachable. And there was this woman sitting in the back who raised her hand, and she said, I'm an octogenarian. I have been in the church my entire life. I have never understood this until this moment. I appreciate the translation work you do for those of us who are not systematic theologians.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. It's been a whole journey. Being a pastor has helped me realize the art that it is to simplify and communicate and translate, that there's no inherent honor in being complex. And if you're too complex that you're the only person that understands, you're actually doing great disservice to the ideas of God and the world and the gospel. There's art in communicating those ideas to people in a way that they can understand, in a way that they can apply to their lives. And the years of being a pastor has made me think that seminary should end, the final capstone class should be developing a children's sermon on a complex theological topic. Because if you cannot explain it to a 5-year-old or a 9-year-old, you haven't gotten to the simplicity and clarity and passion that I think really matters to Jesus, right? Like Jesus is a master at this stuff, and he always has kids in mind as well.
So you and I have been together on this journey for a long time. We went to seminary together. I did not get a PhD in systematic theology. That is where you continued and I stopped. But, you know, we've been in this world of the church and reading the church mothers and fathers and all of these things for years and years. I think I heard two sentences about the idea of natural theology during my entire theological education. So we unpack for us, what is natural theology? Because the more I get into birding, the more I'm realizing, oh, there's a whole book of nature out there that I haven't studied, that I knew nothing about, and it's deeply connected to our faith tradition. Walk us through that one.
Yeah, so yeah, you said the book of nature. It's a pretty classical idea that God has two so-called books for understanding God, that he's communicated who he is, his character, his identity, to the world in two books. One is the book of nature, the book of creation, and then the other one is the book of salvation or redemption, which you could call the Bible, but also also in particular coming as Jesus, right? That Jesus is the fullness of God in human form. And so how do we know for sure who God is? Well, you look into the face of Jesus, the character and identity and mission of Jesus. Quite often the book of Revelation, and not the book of Revelation at the end of the Bible, but Revelation meaning God revealing himself to us. Another way of putting it is general revelation in nature and creation, that we can know God generally, his character, and then versus general revelation, there's special revelation where we know God specially and specifically in the life of God with Israel and in his coming as Jesus. So those are kind of the two books. Yeah.
So why is natural theology important? Why don't we hear about it? And how does it connect to the life of birds?
Well, it connects in my life, but I have a very biographical connection with this. All the way from college into seminary, I was really immersed in specifically Protestant theology from Calvin, and then especially the theology of Karl Barth. And Karl Barth, and I learned a lot of stuff from Barth that I still appreciate, that formed my faith and my theology, but he's famously and passionately against natural theology. And for him, to give him his due, there's a long tradition, especially in European theology, Lutheran theology, and some Reformed theology prior to someone like Barth, where God also speaks through, like, not just creation, but orders of society, like politics or the powers of authority. And he kind of mashed all that together. And for Karl Barth, like, he lived in Germany in the late 30s and early 40s, and he saw the people felt like God was speaking through the political authorities of the day. They chalked it up to the natural powers of this world. And he looked at that and said, yeah, we absolutely should not do that. We should only take our command, our leading from special theology and not from the world. And you can see why that was so important to him. But I got to Vanderbilt and studying for my PhD, and I had a professor who used to be a strong Barthian and became a follower of Thomas Aquinas and Augustine. And he just kept on asking me, he's like, I understand the pastoral practical concern that we should not just listen to political authorities without a critical spirit, but I do not think natural theology, like, inevitably leads to being Nazis. And he just said that to me, like, very practically, that there's a much wider world of how we can know God in nature. There are constraints the Christian tradition has put on so that we don't lead ourselves astray away from the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the God of Jesus. It's not this dangerous world, but I think Protestantism a lot of times has led us astray in that. And look, I'm still a Protestant. I'm a Presbyterian minister. And certainly we should be careful about how we know God, what the things we say about God when we encounter God in nature. But I don't think we should have a suspicion of how we can know God in nature, that if God is both creator and redeemer, both the God of general revelation and special revelation, that there's no inherent tension between what we can learn about God in nature and what we can know about God through special revelation. And I had a real conversion experience my PhD, where I felt like when you're so defensive about we can only know God through special revelation, what we can say about the Bible and what we know about Jesus, it sets up this competition where you sense if you sense competition between creation and nature and what the Bible says, all of a sudden you go into this defensive posture, feeling like you have to defend what we know for sure God is like. And I just don't think that's the posture God wants us to have in the world. It's not helpful for like our spiritual life as people, and it's not helpful for Christian witness in the world. God does not need defending like that. That is not like, that's not who God calls us to be. And I found in natural theology, understanding God through creation and through generally accessible categories and ideas, what I would call a much broader foundation for faith. I think of Augustine, he echoes much of the Christian tradition, saying, look, God as creator is the good of every good. Any good we encounter is an echo. It is an echo of the goodness of God. And any expression of beauty we have in the world is an echo of the most beautiful thing of all, which is God. Every truth we encounter in the world is an echo of the truth that holds together all things, which is the truthfulness of God. And I just found for me just a much broader, joyful foundation for faith that I didn't feel like I had to defend or get into these fights or these mental gymnastics to defend the faith. Of like, look, there's good in the world. There's beauty in the world. Nature is a wonder. And even someone who has no background in the faith, even a kid who has never gone to church, can understand, hey, there's a source for all this goodness. There's a source for all this beauty. And ironically, one of the patron saints of Protestantism that then retaught it to me even in the last 3 or 4 years is C.S. Lewis. Like, C.S. Lewis has absolutely no problem with this. And for some reason, Protestants, like, when they read it in C.S. Lewis, they like embrace it, but if they don't use it to reflect on how Protestantism has generally been very suspicious of it.
So you're saying theological fights are maybe not where it's at.
And they probably are not super helpful for forming us as people.
You think God's interested in that?
I don't think God likes Christianity as fight posture.
Will you tell the people who are mean to me on Twitter about that?
Well, I mean, you see, it's probably not a good thing to be able to see what people will do in a semi-public setting when there is no filter and no shame at all. Yep. It does not help Christian witness, and it probably proves the doctrine of sin more than anything else.
I had a poet friend in college who used to say, you know, I'm not really a Calvinist, but I'm sold on total depravity.
Absolutely, totally.
there's evidence for that all over.
So I didn't get to the birder part yet. I will say, not only has I found creation to be a place where we can know God, and obviously, like, what kind of God creates the whimsy of so many different types of birds, but even beyond what we can know of God, when creation can be a place where we are formed as the kind of people who are become deeper worshipers of God by our time in creation. So it's not just what we can know about God from creation. That's its own kind of question that we can get obsessed with, and it's important, and there are various parts of the Bible that make it clear we can know God as creator and his basic characteristics from God. But even more than that, when we stand in awe of creation and the God who made creation, it trains us as the type of people who become more joyful worshipers, and people who stand in awe of God and the beauty he makes and the way in which it points to him. So it's not just what we know, it's also how it can help us be, inform us, the type of people that I think God really wants us to be.
I love the connection between the natural theology and the birding. I know for me and for many of the guests that I've had on the show who are people of faith who, you know, have shared with me some of their faith story, there have been seasons where because of pain or grief or trauma, it's difficult to pray, mm-hmm. but they can go birding and they find that spark of connection with God again by going out, by looking up, by receiving these gifts of birds. And I think when we bifurcate, when we separate and say, no, like just read your Bible more and strip away the gifts and the beauties of the natural world from the life of the church, from the life of the mind, and kind of make that less than, it's damaging because mm-hmm. there's a lot of good to be mined there.
Yeah, I was reminded of this recently when I read a book by Dr. Keltner called Awe, The New Science of Everyday Wonder and How It Can Transform Your Life. And he goes through 7 or 8 ways in which our bodies and minds and brains and neuroscience are, like, God made us to be people who stand in awe. And one that will stay with me is he calls it communal effervescence, the kind of joy and connection we feel when we are with thousands of other people, and or hundreds, or just, like when we're experiencing connection and it makes us feel connected and stand in awe of what it means to be human and what it means to be community. And here's the thing. Keltner's an atheist. Like, he's a professed atheist. And the way that I was raised up is to be suspicious of what I can learn from an atheistic neuroscientist. And natural theology taught me what it was to learn from an atheist neuroscientist about God's creation. Even if I disagree with him, I don't need to, like, not read the book or pick a fight. Like, I can just be curious and learn alongside him and learn alongside communities like that. And I think even if they don't come to believe in God, if we can take up a posture of curiosity and learning alongside our brethren, our brothers and sisters who are not yet Christians, but are simply made in the image of God as well, that will be a much more eloquent witness to the grace and love of Jesus than fighting with them.
No fighting.
No fighting.
It has been it's been a joy that we've been on this journey together, kind of away from that infighting of, like, theological education and are you right or wrong and which side of the issue are you on? And it's not that these things don't matter. You know, we have opinions and we land places theologically and politically and personally. It's the posture of curiosity and learning and empathy. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be that the person who really disagrees with me has a very different life story than I do. And if I had their life story, I'd be in exactly the position they are. And to engender just basic human skills of listening and kindness and wanting to, you know, as St. Francis said, seek first to understand and then to be understood. It's a journey for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it goes there. There's no reason though, right? We have convictions. We think this is not just everybody feel awe and wonder in the world. Like, truth matters. What you believe about God matters. We are still people who are like that. We still think that worshiping Jesus matters. But that in general, what it means to point to Jesus eloquently in our society today, is to take up that posture of empathy and curiosity, and let God direct the journey of reaching people with the love and hope of Jesus. And see how he uses us on that journey as well.
You should be a pastor.
You know, it's a vibrant time to be a pastor. The American church is going through a special season, and it's hard. And the witness of the church over the last 20 years has been hard in many ways, and that has hurt a lot of people. But there's also an openness to a different way of being a public Christian these days that startles people, surprises people. And I think causes them to wonder whether there's a different way of following Jesus today.
It's a word.
Mm-hmm. It's a good one. And birds provide their own invitation to that whimsy and awe and curiosity as well.
They do, for sure. They keep winging their ways into my sermons. I keep trying to keep them out. They just keep coming back.
People love it. I think part of you.
The best thing about being a pastor who's into birding is probably 25% of the emails and texts I get from the congregation these days are bird photos. And it's either asking for ID, what is this? It was in my yard. Or it's just, hey, we have barn owls and I thought you'd like to see them. And it's such a delight. And it's such an easy, beautiful way to connect with people because, as I've said often on this show, birds are the great unifier. We can fight about everything and we do, right? We fight about politics, we fight about theology, we fight about the weather, but birds are just a joy.
Mm-hmm. It's also good for them to know that our congregation has pastors that are like whole people too. And I always get suspicious when I read a pastoral profile that's like, what does pastor like to do? Read theology. And I'm like, man, like, I don't know. The Christian life is much broader than that.
Speaking of which, I think one of the things that's been most life-giving to you over the past couple of years has been working in the garden, which is a connection to you for natural theology. So you may not be quite as birdy as I am, but what is it about being out in the garden and connecting with nature that fills up your cup?
Yeah, there are a couple things. One is it teaches me, I think, to move with God's time, which is often much, much slower than our time. And I think this is particularly valuable in a world where we so often are interacting with virtual technological worlds. And Wendell Berry's really a great insight for me on this, that virtual technological worlds move at a speed that is not how the world works. It is virtual, and it lulls us into thinking that creation and God's time should work that quickly. And Barry's point is also that easily. It's way easier to dig a trench on the internet than it is to dig a trench in your backyard. And you cannot do it. You cannot change that trench. Like, it is just hard work. And I think encountering the meatiness of the, like, God did not create a virtual world. God created a world of dirt and plants and water and landscape and hard work. And I think God did that for a reason. It reminds us that we're physical beings. We are not minds in a vat. We are physical beings in a physical world, and that forms us into what it means to work with God in the world and to feel God's character, the way that he works slowly and seems to delight in that. And no matter what we do, he does not hurry up. He goes at his own time. And so when I plant strawberries and they start from a little tiny seed and they take months and months and months, and then, but then they finally produce fruit, man, it's beautiful and it tastes really good. And it reminds me that God is also in the ministry of growing fruit, but that God goes on its own time. There's a reason why Jesus is constantly talking about soil and fruit and working the soil. And that seemed much closer to God's heart than many other things.
I think it was Eugene Peterson who said, you know, if you're on your day off, on your Sabbath, on your day of rest, if you work with your mind during the week, you should work with your hands. Mm-hmm. And if you work with your hands during the week, you should, you know, rest with your mind. And rest with your hands, not work with your hands. You're taking a day of rest. And we've really both found that to be true, that we can get so up in our heads with everything church related and all the balls that we're trying to keep in the air family wise. And you just getting some dirt under your fingernails and me getting out on the trail or going out to the marsh. It almost never fails to have that positive effect of lifting our souls. Although I will say, we moved out here 9 years ago, and California, Southern California, is kind of this unique paradise when it's not on fire. But I would like to lodge a complaint that we have mosquitoes now.
Yeah, I don't know what's happened. Lots of ankle biters.
Yeah, I go to the marsh, I wear three layers, and they bite through all three layers. I've been jogging through the marsh recently with my binoculars.
Yeah, it's a great theological question as to whether there will be mosquitoes in the new creation. I don't know.
There will not.
Yeah.
I can answer that one for you. I'm not going if there are mosquitoes.
Checks out.
And every birder who's birding in Canada and Georgia and places where there are way worse bugs think that, you know, I'm kind of a house cat. But I am kind of a house cat. I don't like things biting me.
You've definitely mild out since you moved out here.
I grew up in Wisconsin, and now we're raising these three kids in Southern California who say things like, it's raining. Do we have to go to school?
Yeah, and there were sometimes growing up out here when it rained and we didn't go to school. That's the way it was.
Oh, California. It's getting to me. It's getting to me, Daryl.
So, Courtney, you've asked me about being in the garden and a few other passions of mine. Can I ask you a question about your passions?
No, I'm sorry. This is my podcast.
Okay, and with that, we sign off.
I'm in charge here. Go ahead.
But one of your passions is writing, and I understand you have a new book coming out in the early part of 2024. Will you tell us about it?
I do. I have a bird book coming out. Not like a field guide bird book. I leave that to the professional ornithologist. But I have a book that's about birding and grief and hope. So some of the themes of this podcast are woven through the pages. It is the story, in part, of the death of my grandfather and how birding helped me in my grieving process, my connections with him and birds and the outdoors. It's part natural theology. I'm learning things here as I go, and part humor, but with more pelicans. So it's called Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief. It comes out in April, and I'm just so excited to share it with all of my birding friends and all of my non-birding friends. I've given advanced copies to some folks who aren't birders, and they said, you know, I wasn't really interested, but this is a universal story about grief and hope. And you find your hope in birds, but I find my hope in fill in the blank, trivia night or lacrosse or gardening. Yeah. So it has really been a labor of love. It's been in process for almost 2 years now. By the time it comes out, it'll be almost 2 full years. It takes a long time to get a book out there. Mm-hmm. And the cover, I didn't know this before I was in the book writing world, but authors have actually very little to do with their cover design. Most publishers have, you know, a design team, and they come up with a couple options and they say, which one do you like? And the first option they sent me just took my breath away. It is the most beautiful book cover. They got it. You know, a good book cover should say what the book says in picture form, and even better. And it does. It's beautiful blue cover filled with birds.
And I'm biased, but I think it is your deepest and most profound book. It is a profound reflection on your own journey of grief and what it means to be a human created by God and walking between grief and sadness and hope and joy. Well done.
That's kind of you to say. Yeah. I was working on some of the final edits a few months back, and I said, you know, Daryl, I'm afraid, like, you know, writers all have imposter syndrome, and maybe this book isn't as good as the last one, and I don't know, you know, is it? And Daryl was like, Courtney, it's a great book. And I said, well, you haven't even read it. And he said, yeah, I did. I read it. I helped you with the last round of edits. And I was like, oh, right.
Yeah, you're on your third edit. You're like, the book's not even good. Okay, we've been here before.
This is where we go. This is where we go. You, Daryl will chronicle what's my creative cycle, Daryl?
Oh, I have a good idea. I'm going to write a book. It'll be done tomorrow. It'll be great. Day one, terrible idea. Absolutely not. I'll never finish this book. Anyways, we could go on. There are stages.
And that lasts for 2 years, and then it ends by me saying I'll never write anything ever again, and then 6 months later I have a new idea.
Yes, you have to write things. It is in your bones.
I do. I was thinking in college, I studied communications and asked one of my writing professors, you know, should I become a writer? And this is Dr. Kent Graham, a deeply, deeply wise professor. He was at Wheaton College. I think he's at teaching at Gettysburg now, but...
He wrote a book called Gettysburg, right?
He did, and yeah. It was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. Right. He's kind of a big deal, but he's incredibly humble and self-deprecating. And he said, Courtney, don't become a writer. There's no money in it. You'll starve to death. Don't become a writer. Do something else where you have a passion, where you have a drive. And if you have to write, you won't be able to not write. Like, it will happen in the margins. It will happen in the lunch breaks. It will happen in the vacation days. You will still write. And that has really held true. And I'm grateful to have health insurance. So,
amen.
All right, Daryl, two final questions for you. First, you are a pastor, which is an odd and wondrous calling. You spend a lot of time doing holy things and then a lot of time doing mundane things, like figuring out how to get the youth room clean when there's waffle batter all over, but also doing really, really hard things, you know, sitting at hospital bedsides and presiding over funerals and soaking in death and grief and the collective anxiety of a congregation barreling toward another election. I'm not ready, Daryl. So in the midst of all of that, where are you finding hope?
Finding hope in two things right now. One is we just started a new discipleship program at our church called Roots to Fruits. And, you grow deep roots and you bear beautiful fruit for God.
Who came up with the name for that, Daryl?
Was that you? I don't know. I think
it was you.
No, I don't think
it was not me.
No.
I'm not taking credit. I was trying to give you some
It was
some
it was props. Our elder, Clayton Simon.
Perfect.
Yes. The great Clayton Simon. But we just started it 4 weeks ago, and to watch, you know, a really good segment of our church, you know, it's about 80 to 90 people a week who are making a commitment to add an hour to grow in their faith and discipleship at church. And the hunger I've seen from them to learn, to grow, to reflect and share, and to continue going deeper in their life of discipleship. It's just really, it gives me great hope for the church that in the midst of all our fragmentation and division, that there is a hunger for the goodness and beauty and truth of the gospel. And if we invite people into it, they really are hungry to be a part of it. And I take great, great hope in that, both for God's future and the future of the church. And the other place is I take great hope in kids in general and our kids in particular. They're just amazing. And there's a reason I think that Jesus constantly loved kids and then invited us to be like kids. There's great maturity in becoming more like kids and their silliness and their wrestling and their curiosity. By question 500 in the day, I wonder whether curiosity is the virtue I really believe it is. I'm glad that they model for me what it is to live in wonder and curiosity in the world. And I take great hope in that.
Man, the questions, Daryl.
Many, many questions. I had a congregant text me a Babylon Bee story that about a dad who, quote, died by too many questions by 9 a.m. And I thought, yeah, I totally identify with that.
Our middle kid especially, he's 7 years old, and something in his brain is just in full-on curiosity mode. And he's also a gearhead, so he wants to know how everything works. But, you know, Daryl and I are getting up in the morning and we're staggering toward our hot beverages to try to wake up, and he comes like fully loaded with 20 questions he's been thinking about all night about how the toaster works and why sharks swim the way they do, and if astronauts eat carrots in space, do they make any crumbs? And we're like, babe.
Yeah, it makes it, you know, to come full circle, it was reading a Catholic theologian named Bernard Lonergan that really helped my conversion towards natural theology. And one of the things that I remember from that great book, Insight, that I was reading that was really key in my conversion towards natural theology was he just made this observation about the human mind and intellect. And he said, you never have to teach kids to ask, what is that? And that is just profoundly true and points to the spirit of curiosity that God put in us to go explore the world as an invitation to get to know him as well.
Did he have kids?
What is that? No, but he knows.
He had to have kids.
I mean, dude was smart. What is that? Why is that?
As just a side note, one of my favorite Daryl getting a PhD stories is we lived in two separate states for a while. I was finishing a degree in seminary in New Jersey, and Daryl was starting his PhD program in Nashville, and we couldn't pay double rents. So we reached out kind of through a church and college alumni network, and a couple, wonderful couple named Ted and Heather said Daryl could live with them for free, which just mind-blowing. They'd never met him. You know, we're like, we promise he's not an axe murderer. He's a responsible guy. But Daryl would leave his PhD books lying all over their house. And Ted, who's a lawyer, like he's a brilliant guy, but he does not read philosophical theology. It's like not his thing, would put little sticky notes on Daryl's books.
Yeah. Yeah. So like I was reading a book called A Theology, The Face of the Deep, A Theology of Becoming by Catherine Keller, a beautiful book. And he wrote he put on a sticky note that said after this, so the subtitle was A Theology of Becoming, and he wrote a sticky note that said, becoming what? Question mark. And it was beautiful.
There were a lot of books that had very esoteric titles, and Ted found all of them. And I loved him for it because I was living too far away to be able to rib Daryl about some of the stuff he was reading. And yeah.
I think it was that Lonergan book called Insight, and the description on the back said, insight into insight provides great insight. And you were like, yeah, no.
No, I love you so much. I will never read this.
Book changed my life, though.
I read novels. So good. And I love and appreciate you. But
I've become more literary. I'm not sure you've become more systematic theology.
Nope, and I never will. Never will. I used to come home from classes in seminary and say, Daryl, doctrine of God, please explain. And we'd just sit over dinner and he'd be like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I was like, great, I'm going to get an A on this paper. Bless you.
But I'm much more likely these days to say, doctrine of God, let's go talk about birds.
Right? Let me show you some duck photos, as our friend Paul Wallace is apt to say. All right, Daryl, let's bring it home. Final question. This is our last episode before our Christmas break. We're going to take the next 2 weeks off to rest and play, and we will be back with you in the new year with some phenomenal special guests. I cannot wait to share these episodes with you. They are an absolute delight. But we're going to end this podcast, as we end so many others, with the hardest question of them all. Daryl Ellis, pastor, systematic theologian, PhD, smarty pants, what's your favorite bird?
My favorite bird is a black-billed magpie, because the first time I went to the Monastery of Christ in the Desert in New Mexico, which has become something of a spiritual home for me, Courtney, before I left to go there, said, if you see a magpie, tell me, because I've always wanted to see one. And you went to Colorado to look for one and came up empty. And I went to the monastery, and right outside my room for the first time was just a whole, well, I don't know, they're probably not a flock, there's some specialty term for them, but 6 to 8 beautiful black-billed magpies. And I just remember that it's this connection to this deep place where God met me and changed my life, and I'm grateful for it.
I would not have guessed a magpie.
That
makes me happy to know they are beautiful. They wear their little tuxedos. Mm-hmm. They're in the corvid family, so they're in that smart family of they're going to dig through your trash and find all your goodies. Yeah, I love a magpie. I did eventually see a magpie, but it took several attempts. And I know if you live in Colorado or you live in New Mexico, they're super, super common. But those are the nemesis birds, right? The ones that are super common, and you go out and you try to find them and you can't find them. Right now, for me, it's the swinhose white eye. They are literally in my friends' yards, and I'll go to my friends' yards, and then they're no longer in my friends' yards. Mm-hmm. But that's the That's the fun of the hunt. Mm-hmm. Well, Daryl, anything else you'd like our listeners to know before we sign off for the holiday season?
No, so fun to watch what this podcast has become, and well done.
Oh, you're kind. Thank you for just all the support and all the love and allowing me to have this little recording studio in the corner of our bedroom. All right, my friends, that is it for this episode of the Thing with Feathers podcast. We're going to take a 2-week Christmas hiatus, holiday hiatus. We wish you and yours a wonderful holiday season, and we'll be back in the new year with more birds and hope. The Thing with Feathers is produced by me, Courtney Ellis. Many thanks to Del Belcher for the music, to Todd Peterson for the name inspiration, and to Emily Dickinson for the beautiful poem and for being in the public domain. Until next time, my friends, keep looking up.
What does it go in your soul? Yes, it does.